From NPR News, this is live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. I'm Audie Cornish. Surprise, when it happens to a government, is likely to be a complicated, diffuse, bureaucratic thing. It includes neglect of responsibility, but also responsibility so poorly defined or so ambiguously delegated that action gets lost. Those words were written 50 years ago by a Nobel Prize-winning economist and historian Thomas Schelling in a book about the attack on Pearl Harbor. But our next guest quotes them in the context of the September 11th attacks and the effect on our national security system. Philip Zelikow served as executive director of the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States, more commonly known as the 9/11 Commission. He helped compile the original 9/11 report, and he's now written an update on the commission's recommendations. We spoke with Mr. Zelikow this past week from New York, and he told us how the government has followed through on some of the commission's key recommendations.
Our most important institutional recommendation was to create a National Counterterrorism Center, or an NCTC, that would bridge the domestic foreign divide, that would pool a lot of the information available and make sure that somebody was working on the key problems. That actually is a substantial success. So that's on the very much on the plus side. Probably the biggest minus is the failure of Congress to change the way in which it oversees the intelligence community.
There are well over 100 different sort of departments and area of security that are overseen by dozens of committees on Capitol Hill.
Right. So you have a dysfunctional congressional management of homeland security in the committee system you just described. Then the intelligence community used to have its budget hidden in the defense budget. So all of its appropriations were approved by the subcommittee that does defense appropriations. But now its budget is broken out. The top line of the intelligence budget is public. So the reason for hiding it in the defense appropriations subcommittee is gone. But the defense appropriations subcommittee won't give it up.
Another issue specifically on that day was the emergency radio system for first responders. It was a huge problem, especially for the New York Fire Department. And I want to play a clip of a moment of testimony before the 9/11 Commission in May of 2004. Former Mayor Rudy Giuliani was about to give his testimony when the audience interrupted him.
These people...
This was a very emotional meeting, and later on, your commission recommended dealing with the shortage of broadcast spectrum. Can you talk about the status of this recommendation today?
We still have a problem in that there's not enough broadcast spectrum available for emergency service agencies in a lot of cities. So the commission recommended that a chunk of unallocated broadcast spectrum, is known as the D block, be set aside for the emergency service agencies to use. But to actually use that part of the broadcast spectrum, you'd need to build a lot of very expensive infrastructure and equipment to use it. And the cities and the local governments just don't have the kind of money that would be needed to build that kind of equipment. Congress hasn't been able to come up with a solution yet.
Philip Zelikow, knowing what you know, do you feel any safer today?
I do feel safer today. I think, we're not safe and we shouldn't be complacent. One of the hard problems is, how do you talk about this? How do you tell people that we've made things better without inviting a sense of complacency and dulling the alertness that we need to maintain? But we need to adjust to a situation where we become more resilient as a society. We have reduced the scale of this problem through actions overseas and things we've done at home. We've made things safer. So now we need to adjust to a world in which our systems are going to be attacked from a lot of different places and sources. And the measure of a society in many ways is not whether or not you can prevent every single attack. It's how do you respond when you are attacked. I think that's one of the lessons that we're absorbing as a society as we look back on the last 10 years and think about what's the best and the worst that these crises brought out in us is the gain in our maturity and our resilience as a community and how we cope with these problems and move on and go on with our lives.
Philip Zelikow is executive director of the 9/11 Commission. He spoke with us from New York. Philip Zelikow, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Audie.
9 days after the attacks, then-President George W. Bush addressed a joint session of Congress and launched the War on Terror. among its goals, to end state sponsorship of terrorism, destroy terrorist organizations, and kill terrorists. Dina Temple-Raston is part of NPR's national security team covering counterterrorism at home and abroad. She joins us now to talk about the war on terrorism today. Hi there, Dina.
Hi there.
In recent days, authorities have actually raised security concerns about a possible terrorist attack planned around this state. What's the latest on that?
Well, the threat hasn't really changed since we first learned about it on Wednesday. Essentially, there was some intelligence from a good source in Pakistan that indicated al-Qaeda might have put a plan in motion to coincide with the 9/11 anniversary. But the information was incredibly vague. We understood that there were three operatives. Maybe there was an American among them. Maybe they were coming to the U.S. to launch an attack. Maybe they were already here. Maybe it would be car bombs, perhaps against transportation targets in New York City and Washington. And while, you know, intelligence officials tell us they thought this was a very good source of information, in other words, a source who had been helpful in the past, they can't find those other intelligence strings that corroborate all of this.
Right. The description has been credible but unconfirmed.
Exactly. And so they're checking and rechecking. And the latest information that we have is that nothing has popped up to change that status.
Let's talk more in general about what counterterrorism officials point to as the greatest threat facing the U.S. today.
Well, as you know, a lot's been made lately of administration officials who have said that al-Qaeda is has lost its punch and that it's in the midst of a strategic defeat. The thing is that al-Qaeda now has morphed. It has all these different affiliates now, other groups that believe in their same ideas but in fact aren't related to the core group. And those are the people that intelligence officials worry about. In particular, there's an affiliate in Yemen that's known as al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And that group has American members. And it's already tried to attack the United States twice. They were behind the attempted bombing of the U.S. Airliner a couple of Christmases ago, and that failed cargo bomb plot last Thanksgiving.
The FBI came under tremendous criticism for the intelligence, people say, failures of 9/11. What effect did that have on the agency?
Well, it's hard to know, actually, where to start on how much the FBI has changed. I mean, it's essentially become a domestic intelligence service, like the United Kingdom's MI5. I mean, it used to investigate cases specifically to bring criminal prosecution. Now it sees its role as preventing terrorism before it can happen. And so it's less about prosecution and building a case for court than stepping in before the crime. As opposed to afterwards. And now the Bureau is under tremendous criticism for that. Are they going too far in actually entrapping people who might have in their head that they want to do some sort of terrorist act but never intend to attack or do anything about it? And I think right now they're kind of groping around for the right balance. But the FBI has completely changed its mission over the past 10 years more than just about any other agency I can think of.
Dina, hearing you talk about that also makes me think of this idea of sort of lone operator, people who have the potential to act as terrorists who aren't working in a formal group. How has the internet changed the way terrorists operate?
Well, it's exactly that. It gives lone wolves power that they never had before because they can find like-minded people that they might never find before. They can find information on how to do something. I mean, the very bright side of texting and SMS that we saw for the Arab Spring unfortunately also works to the advantage of the dark side as well.
That was NPR's counterterrorism correspondent, Dina Temple-Raston. Thank you, Dina.
You're very welcome.
We now turn to the Pentagon and NPR's Tom Bowman. Tom, you were there at the ceremony this morning honoring those who died when United Airlines Flight 77 hit the building 10 years ago. Describe the ceremony.
Well, it was the top military leadership, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, and also Vice President Joe Biden was here, too, talking to some 1,200 family members, and also about 150 survivors of the attacks, those who were wounded that day. And most of all the speakers really talked about how the attack, it's still fresh. The wounds are in some cases are still raw. But they also talked about how it strengthened the resolve of the American people. And here's Vice President Joe Biden. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Al-Qaeda and bin Laden never imagined that the 3,000 people who lost their lives that day would inspire 3 million to put on the uniform and harden the resolve of 300 million Americans. They never imagined the sleeping giant they were about to awaken.
Tom, do we know how military enlistment changed after 9/11?
Well, a huge number of folks got into the military after 9/11, and they were, people who worked on Wall Street, lawyers and so forth, who abandoned careers to join the military. There was a huge surge in recruiting at that time.
And how is it doing now?
Military recruiting is doing quite well, and part of that, frankly, is due to the poor economy. For a while, the military had trouble recruiting in the middle of the wars once the death toll started rising and the casualties started coming home. So they were forced to take those with who didn't score as well in the aptitude tests, who had minor crimes under their belt. It was a problem for a while, and the military was openly talking about that. Today, they're getting a higher quality of recruit, and again, part of that is because it's a pretty bad economy right now, Audie.
At the same time, there's talk that the Army and the Marines will begin to downsize once the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are over. What are you hearing about that?
Well, they're talking about maybe tens of thousands of Marines and soldiers being drawn down over the coming years. And one of the concerns that Marine and Army leaders have is that they don't want to draw them down too much. They're still involved in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's still, of course, about 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. There are repeated deployments for many in Afghanistan. So they don't want to draw down too quickly and put an extra burden on those who remain in the military. So, but clearly with the budget the way it is now and the cuts needed, everyone is anticipating that the cuts in troop levels will likely be larger than what anyone anticipated.
And Tom, in our last minute, I want to hear what you heard from family members who were there for the ceremony today.
Well, we talked to a couple of women today. There was Michelle Michaeloff from Nashville and also Adrian Anderson from Sacramento. And they lost their cousin, Navy Lieutenant Commander Dave Williams. He was in the Pentagon that day in the Navy Command Center and was killed. And tragically, his wife was pregnant that day with their third child. And he was at the ceremony as well today, a 9-year-old boy. But what really struck me today, the most moving part of the ceremony was wreaths were laid at each of the benches, 184 benches of those who were killed. And you watch the family members, some of them almost lost in thought, sitting on the benches or walking around, hugging each other or having their pictures taken. It was really quite a moving event.
NPR's Tom Bowman at the Pentagon. Tom, thank you.
You're welcome, Audie.
NPR's Robert Siegel joins us again from New York, where he's been observing the day's ceremony at the National September 11 Memorial and Museum. Robert, give us a sense of what we heard this morning at the events at Ground Zero.
Well, the main thing that we've heard and that we're still hearing is the reading of the names of those who died on 9/11 in the towers, on the plains, at the Pentagon in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Also, those who died in 1993 at the World Trade Center in the bombing that year. There are nearly 3,000 names that will be read. We're not quite at 2,800 yet. You can figure we'll be here for another several minutes at least. We've also seen something fascinating, Audie, which is that as the families of those who died, who are really the center of this observance here, as they enter the memorial behind the stage just across West Street from where we're looking at this from 10 stories up, they're taking to the memorial. They're the first people to actually go inside and use it. And just as people do at the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., they are finding the names of their loved ones, which are inscribed in brass around the two large pools which form this memorial, one on the footprint of the North Tower, one the South Tower, and they're making rubbings, leaving roses, but above all, making rubbings of the name of their father, husband, brother, sister, wife, who died on 9/11. And you can begin to see this memorial for 9/11 being used by people. It's not open to the public yet and won't be for some time. You'll need a ticket to enter when it does open, but now it's being used by the families who are also sitting in the grass, relaxing, enjoying as best they can this day. The president gave a reading earlier. He read from the 46th Psalm?
Yes.
President George W. Bush read from a letter that Abraham Lincoln sent to a woman he thought had lost five sons in the Civil War. I gather she didn't, as it turns out. And we've heard from Rudolph Giuliani, then mayor of New York City, who read from Ecclesiastes. So it's been, we've heard from dignitaries who have honored the families and the dead with their presence. But above all, this is a ceremony for those families. And it's a ceremony that has entailed members of the family reading the names in alphabetical order and also including a little message for their loved one who died that day. A very, very moving ceremony, a very beautiful and now useful memorial for those who lost people on 9/11.
It's interesting to see. I can see on screen here, people are placing little stemmed flowers or little American flags. They're tucking them into the engravings of the names of their loved ones, as well as you said, placing paper over it with a pencil and making a rubbing of the etching.
Yes, the flags and flowers are appearing throughout. I must say the ceremony is there's a rhythm to it. People stand and they articulate and they practice the very often exotic names that they must read as they're assigned a group of a half dozen or 10 names to read. But then each gives a message to the person they lost: a bond trader, a firefighter, a passenger aboard an airplane. And one after another, you see how emotional that becomes and how it moves from a very well-rehearsed reading to a moment that's pretty difficult for lots of people, even if it is 10 years on.
Especially many of those moments, you have children or teenagers reading the names of family members.
Yes, they're addressing their father who died or their grandmother whom they barely knew or perhaps they weren't even born yet. I think that as big as global event as this 10th anniversary is, the ceremony at the World Trade Center site remains something that's really mostly about those who died and those who survived them. And there's been relatively little rhetoric, accompanying any of this very little connection to any national or local policies at all. Just remembering those who died, many in acts of courage. The great number of firefighters whom we're commemorating today, one after another, remind us of the sacrifice that was made by some pretty heroic New Yorkers on 9/11 10 years ago.
And we're going to hear some of the names being read by family members at the World Trade Center site in New York.
And my brother, Archangel Vasquez, God, we thank you very much for giving me a brother like an angel. On behalf of my mother, Ida, who's in Puerto Rico.
You're listening to live coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks from NPR News.